This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
This is Spaces Podcast, where we aim to elevate the appreciation and understanding of the spaces we occupy every day. Hello, my name is Demetrius. This is Michelle.
Hey, everyone.
This is Jason.
Hey, guys.
And you are listening to Spaces Podcast. Welcome back, everyone. We are all over the place. By the time you're hearing this, hopefully this is all over, but with the quarantine, we're all over the place. So
I don't think we've addressed that yet, have we?
No, not yet. So we'll touch on that at some point, but not today. So today we're discussing a specific project. It's called Recompose, and we'll touch a little bit on cemeteries in general. But I'll start with you, Jason. How are you with the conversation of death?
Conversation of death?
Yeah.
Well, you can't, you know, it's funny. I don't have a problem with it at all. Long story short, I always thought actually I was going to perish a long time ago when I was young. So it doesn't bother me. It's kind of one of those people. It's like, you can't have one without the other. So yeah. There's no life without death. There's no death without light. There's no light without dark, blah, 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 blah. So it really has never freaked me out. But I do know several people where it's like one of those things that's just a totally taboo subject.
Yeah. Michelle, are you okay with the conversation of death?
I'm totally fine with it. I think it's just a part of life. I mean, as Jason said, you know, it's just part of what living is. At the end of life, literally, we all will perish.
What about your perception of cemeteries?
I think they're beautiful. Like, as goofy as it sounds, I think sometimes they're some of the prettiest places I've seen. And as I drive through, I live in Orange, and there's actually quite a few around us, you know, within like a 10-mile radius, you know, a lot of the older streets and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I find myself every time I drive through looking at them consistently, just because I think there's actually some pretty cool architecture in some of the areas. Mm-hmm. And then very rarely in our environment these days do you get landscape and yardage, you know, that's just open and maintained and kind of pretty. I like them.
Michelle, what about you?
So I'm half Asian, and the Asian culture, and I think there are other cultures as well, It's very common to gather family often at cemetery sites and honor and, speak with those who have passed. So I kind of grew up going, at least 2 times a year, sometimes 3 times, 4 on some of like more major holidays, see my grandparents or to visit my grandparents along with my aunts and uncles and cousins. And we would bring food to the grave and we'd sit there and we'd have incense and we'd just sort of gather. And it wasn't somber. It was sort of just a time to get together as a family. And I remember, so my grandparents are buried in Rose Hills or at Rose Hills, which is kind of in LA County, Whittier, a really, really beautiful cemetery, sits up on a giant hill. And like, I remember as a kid, like we would go and we would roll down the hill. I mean, so it wasn't like a sad time. It was a time to just gather all of the family and really celebrate those who had, passed before us. So I think maybe that's why I don't have any weird, feelings about cemeteries. I mean, yeah, there are some that are kind of creepy or eerie, like if you look more at some of the historical ones, but then there's also historical ones that are absolutely stunning.
Yeah, the interesting thing about it is that they were actually sort of some of our earliest parks, and people used to actually have events there. And we'll dig into it a little bit more in the history section later. But yeah, I feel like it's, at least in the United States, it's a very different perception as far as the majority of people. But like you guys mentioned, some people don't have that sort of perception of a cemetery. We're going to dig into this project because right now there's 2 main options currently. There's either traditional burial or cremation. And now this project, Recompose, which is going to be built in Seattle. The first one's going to be built in Seattle. It's going to be the world's first facility for converting human remains into soil. So with that, you can plant a tree or garden or anything like that. So it'll be interesting to hear from our guests a little bit more about that. He is principal and owner of the world-renowned firm Olson Kundig, where he leads the interdisciplinary team of architects, designers, visual artists, and researchers. His team designs buildings, parks, and gardens, installations, sculpture, digital art, graphic novels, and film. For over 2 decades, he has pursued unconventional design challenges in public places. His built international portfolio includes museums, installations, exhibits, visitor-based destinations, and urban park projects. Please help me welcome Alan Maskin. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Demetrius. Hello, everybody.
Alan, outside of your bio, anything else you want to share with the audience, hobbies or anything about Olson Kundig that people may need to know?
Well, I think that it's kind of hard to even have any conversation without acknowledging the sort of environment that we're all living under and the sort of global challenge that everybody is facing. So my firm, which is located in Seattle, Washington, we have 1 large studio in Seattle, and about 3 weeks ago, we moved to what was almost 200 separate studios. So, and like much of the world, there was this ability and this need to actually sort of go into quarantine and into a kind of lockdown, but also to sort of stay connected and to sort of try to maintain things as best we could. So there is that aspect of practice. And I'm talking to you today from, I live across Puget Sound from Seattle, and so I'm actually sitting in my bedroom in a tiny cabin that I live in out here. The conversation that we're going to have and what you had wanted to talk about in relationship to Recompose is a particularly challenging conversation to have in light of what is going on in the world at this exact moment. And so I think for us not to acknowledge the amount of death that's happening globally and the suffering that is happening as a consequence would be a tremendous oversight. So I just wanted to begin by saying that we are going to be talking about a rather revolutionary act of death care and one that has been a movement around the world. And in some ways, maybe this pandemic points out why it is perhaps more necessary than ever before.
Yeah, that's a great sentiment to frame this whole conversation. Now, Alan, I'd like you to kind of set us up with what Recompose is. But before we do that, we want to give a little bit of understanding about how death care has evolved throughout history. And to do that, got to go back in time. About 120,000 years ago, the earliest known burials occurred in the Middle East. For much of human history prior to this point, humans didn't bury their dead. The deceased were removed and or honored in various other ways. They were left in caves, trees, and on mountaintops, sunken in lakes, floated out to sea, ritually cannibalized, or cremated. Surprisingly, the first occurrences of burials are thought to have been for transgressors, as an exclusion from rituals that were intended to honor the dead. However, burial displayed advantages, protecting the body from scavengers and the elements, and shielding loved ones from the sight of decomposition. These advantages likely began to shift views on burial to a new way to honor the dead.
We have finite lives here on Earth. Eventually we wind down, all living things do. And when that happens, we have to do something with the deceased.
That's Keith Eggener, professor of architectural history at the University of Oregon, editor of the Journal of the Society of Architectural Historians, a columnist for Places Journal, and author of the book titled Cemeteries. Keith helped shed some light on the purpose, historical significance, and evolution of cemeteries.
Cemeteries are one of the primary ways in which we have dealt with the disposal of our dead over the course of several thousand years now. They serve to accommodate the mortal remains of the deceased, while also providing a place for their survivors to commemorate them, to mourn, to memorialize, to gather. Actually, they serve as many purposes, I would say, probably more purposes for the living than they do for the dead.
Communal burial first appeared in North Africa and West Asia around 10 to 15,000 years ago, coinciding with the first permanent settlements. Nomadic Scythians prepared mounds of earth and stone raised over a grave or graves known as kurgans. Etruscans built expansive necropoles, large designed cemeteries on a grid pattern lined with elaborate tomb monuments. Rome had subterranean catacombs with cremation urns and intact remains. This shift towards burial also preserved the act of burying the dead with tools and other items, which signified a belief in the afterlife. The concept of resurrection emerged in ancient religious writings, mostly in reference to deities, but it was the belief of a judgment day or resurrection of the dead found in many religions that would further solidify the importance of burial throughout society. While some believed in the resurrection of the spirit, others believed the physical body would be resurrected. In medieval Europe, open space was rare, but Christian churches utilized their open yards to accommodate the dead. These spaces simultaneously hosted markets, fairs, and even allowed farmers' cattle to graze in them, believing it made for sweeter milk. From about the 7th century, European burial was under the control of the church. Practices varied, but bodies were usually buried in mass graves until they had decomposed. The bones were then exhumed and stored along the perimeter of the cemetery or in the church under the floor slabs and behind walls. By the end of the 19th century, negative impacts on groundwater from the burial of corpses caught the attention of scientists. In 1879, the French Society for Hospital Hygiene noticed the relationship between typhoid fever and groundwater contaminated by leachates from a cemetery in Paris. Somewhat sweet-tasting water and an unpleasant smell was found coming from the wells located close to cemeteries in Paris. In the process of decomposition, a human body leaches a liquid that contains pathogenic bacteria, viruses, chemical substances applied in chemotherapy and embalming processes, makeup, as well as various additional items that may contaminate the groundwater. Subsequently, some cemeteries were moved away from heavily populated areas and were prohibited in inner city locations. Even in the fairly new country of the United States, the impacts of burial were quickly realized as population increase, land prices increase, and Americans wanted to provide better amenities for citizens.
There was something, frankly, unwholesome about having all of these bodies planted in the midst of the city. Sometimes during floods or other conditions, coffins would become sort of slip their bounds. There are stories of, you know, floods in New York where coffins were floating down Wall Street and such in the midst of a flood because, you know, they became somehow unmoored from where they'd been. And so there was a lot of concern about the hygienic aspects. I mean, keep in mind that throughout the course of the 18th and 19th century in these large cities in Europe and the Americas, well, the kind of conditions we're suffering right now with COVID-19 were frankly pretty common. Every few years, there would be a typhoid outbreak or a cholera outbreak or an influenza outbreak or, you know, some other, you know, horrible disease for which there was really no remedy. And people didn't really know how diseases spread. The prevailing or the leading theory was something called the miasma theory, which suggested that these kind of toxic vapors would rise up from swamps and other such places and carry these kind of toxic clouds around and infect people. And burial grounds were seen as one place where that might well happen. So the idea of locating burial grounds, very densely packed burial grounds, like, you know, again, there were hundreds of thousands of bodies buried on several levels, one atop the other, in a place like Trinity Churchyard in New York. To have all of these thousands of bodies densely packed into, you know, densely built and occupied urban space was just no longer seen as a good practice. And so by the 1830s, in conjunction with the Greek revival and the fashionability of Père Lachaise and the economic considerations I was just mentioning, it came to be seen as desirable to move those graveyards out of town to what were called rural cemeteries. And so you then have the onset of what was called the rural cemetery movement.
The cemetery reform movement led to spacious landscape cemeteries outside of city limits and embodied an idea of state or private controlled cemeteries rather than church-led burials.
They were often, you know, seen as important amenities to the city. Now, keep in mind, again, at this time period in the 1830s, 40s, and well into the 1850s, a lot of things that we more or less take for granted now just simply didn't exist in most places in the United States. Public parks, botanical gardens, art museums. A cemetery, also with beautiful landscaping and horticulture, the sculpture of fine statuary and the architecture of lavish tombs, the grave sites of prominent men and women of local repute, and all of the reference to local history and so on, these became seen as real ornaments to the city. And they became very popular places to visit, to picnic, to take carriage rides, to bring your distinguished guests who were visiting from out of town. You know, this was, again, one of the nicest places to go in a lot of cities. And in fact, they then served as inspiration for later parks and suburban subdivisions and eventually landscaped college campuses and corporate parks and other kinds of landscape designs that we find still to this day across the United States.
Interestingly, the development of cemeteries have created an unexpected effect. As Keith explains, cemeteries sort of doubled as a time capsule of society.
You find a whole language of funerary architecture, tomb sculpture and freestanding sculpture and other things that speak to the concerns and outlook of the era. So in this period, the 1830s and 40s, for instance, we have a shift from the earlier Puritan aesthetic of the 17th and early 18th century, where gravestones would often have memento mori imagery, reminders of mortality. imagery which might include such things as an hourglass with the sands running out, or a skeleton with wings, you know, flying off to the heavens. That language shifts very much by the 1830s, 1840s to a much more kind of poetic and a discrete sort of language that speaks far less directly about death as death and decay, and now speaks about death as a kind of sleep. And so the grave itself starts to look more like a bed, with the stone as a kind of headboard almost. And the imagery on those headboards have things like weeping willows, cheery little cherubs, you know, smiling up at the heavens, hands reaching upward or hands reaching downward. So again, the language of gravestones and grave markers changes. But also keep in mind that, you know, as we look around the United States, one thing that I think often Europeans comment on when they come to the United States is just, you know, everything looks so new, because we have a tendency to not be very interested in preserving a whole lot of our past. What was it? The economist Joseph Schumpeter back in the 40s talked about, you know, creative destruction. We are a people architecturally and urbanistically who practice creative destruction. We tear down a lot of our present in order to make way for a brave new future. That may pertain very much to the center of most large American cities that had vibrant economies. Where it doesn't pertain, though, is in cemeteries. Cemeteries, because of our rather unusual practice of burial in perpetuity, which is quite different from what people practice in most other parts of the world, where you buy a grave plot for a fixed period of time, and then after that period of time is up, your descendants either pay up again for another lease, or else you're carted off to a charnel house and somebody else is planted in the same hole. You know, that's what happens in a lot of Europe and a lot of Latin America and other places. Here we have this notion of burial in perpetuity. I shall be planted in this plot of ground with this stone, and it is mine forever. And, you know, everyone will come and visit me, you know, for time immemorial. So with that idea, cemeteries, well, they fill up for one thing, and they also become kind of fixed cityscapes. You know, think about the cemetery as, well, as it's often called, a necropolis. It's a city of the dead. It's a mere image of the city of the living right next door, right? But this city of the dead, unlike the city of the living, which is constantly changing and growing, the city of the dead, yes, it changes and grows too, but much more slowly, and very little is ever torn down. So as you walk around it, you know, you see these progressions of American architecture, the different fashions, the styles that were fashionable in the city of the living contemporaneously. So just as the Greek revival prevailed in the 1820s and 30s, let's say, in New York or Philadelphia, and then the Egyptian revival came along, and then the Gothic revival came along by the 1850s, you know, and you have these stylistic trends in urban architecture, you see those same trends manifested in the architecture of graveyards.
Our rapidly evolving society begs the question of cemeteries' relevance to society today.
You know, one of the statistics I'm most fond of quoting is the fact that in 1950, there were 2.5 billion people on Earth. Now, 70 years later, there are 7.5 billion people on Earth. There's just a whole lot more of us, and all of us are going to die. That's just going to happen. It's inevitable. There's no getting around it. Meanwhile, of course, we're all a lot more aware than we were even 10 or 20 years ago about environmental degradation that we perpetuate across the planet. You know, so these kinds of practices, cremation, green burial, and so on, I think will play an ever greater role in the future. I think we'll still see traditional burial being practiced probably in rural places, more conservative rural places, for instance, where there's more land and less developmental pressure. And I think it will continue to be practiced as a kind of a status symbol in urban areas as well, for those who can afford it or those who choose to devote a significant portion of their resources.
Today, the perception and use of cemeteries has changed greatly. The declining use by the living, capacity limitations, continued environmental and health concerns, rising populations and demand for real estate, and many religions' shifting stances on the importance of the traditional burial has inspired a reimagining and rethinking of how we depart with our loved ones, such as collective memorials for cremated individuals, or even more explorative concepts like being launched into space, being converted into jewelry, fireworks, or ink for tattooing.
As someone who has always been interested in cemeteries and who likes those spaces and really values what they represent, a recognition of our ancestors, of our past, of our continuity in time and space, I would hate to see them disappear altogether, but I certainly recognize that they almost certainly will be radically reduced in size and number. But frankly, a lot of people speak very dismissively about cemeteries as wasted land. I think that's nonsense. I mean, that's like saying that a room with lofty ceilings that makes your spirit soar is wasted because it's not being practically filled with utilitarian purposes. I mean, a lot of, you know, valuable things that we do and make and build from a purely utilitarian standpoint are wasted. But, you know, is that the kind of world we want to live in, where everything is measured in, you know, utilitarian and just bare economic terms? Cemeteries, traditional ones, have a great deal of cultural and historical and poetic and aesthetic value.
So we talked a little bit about, sort of primed the concept of Recompose, but wanted to kind of throw it to you to fill that out and talk a little bit about what Recompose is, sure, and kind of what inspired it.
Sure. It was created and envisioned by an architect, and her name is Katrina Spade, and she was going to architecture school in UMass, and she was working on her thesis project, and she began to become interested in the idea of human composting as an experiment to sort of explore in terms of all of its aspects, not only the sort of technical aspects of what it takes for a human body to become organic soil and a non-toxic reaction to the ways that we leave the world. But she also wanted to imagine the sort of cultural aspects that would go along with it. And so when she graduated, you know, there's an argument, I think, and maybe you guys would agree with this, that you keep thinking about your thesis project your entire career. And she very actively pursued hers. And so she made it her sort of life's work. And so I first met Katrina about 5 or 6 years ago. A friend of mine who was actually a designer of memorials and tombstones in Seattle, among many other things, he's an artist. He said, you really have to meet this woman. She has the most interesting idea. And so I invited her down to Olson Kunduk studio and we had a cup of tea. I don't think she drinks coffee, if I remember correctly. And we just talked about her idea. And I imagine, much like probably the three of you listening to this or the people out there, when you first hear the notion of when you die about moving into human composting or becoming organic soil, I think people go into a kind of shock. I think in the first place that they go in their own minds is, would I do this? Would this be good for me? And that's exactly where I went. We were having a cup of tea in our office. I was like, it seemed like such a radical idea. And at first I began to wonder if in fact I would be capable of doing that. And then the more she talked about how non-toxic it was and how toxic the other alternatives that are currently in terms of particularly burial in the ground or cremation, which both take away from the planet every time a person dies in terms of the climate. So I sort of went into that place of imagining myself, but the more she talked about it, the more I realized that not only would it be good for me, but I felt it would be good literally for the world, that this was something that is a way that that everyone could give back more positively in the process. And so she kind of won me over at that point. And we continued to talk for years. And I was on her advisory council. And as she began to develop this idea, which was purely a conceptual idea, but she continued to move it along. And we have a creative residency program where people could apply to come to work at our office. And they could make use of all of the tools and the architects and the designers and the engineers that worked there and the interns to develop their project for 1 month. And she was our beta test. We had Katrina come in first. And she brought with her a team of designers and engineers and people doing research from different universities. And they designed the vessel. And the vessel is really a key piece. And we'll send you renderings, Demetrius, if you haven't got them already, but it depicts what it looks like. And what they figured out and what they designed was the prototype that became the vessel that's being sort of created right now. And what happens is a human body is sort of laying in the vessel, and then along with some compost to help start it, it takes 3 months for the human body to actually decompose into organic soil. And they're actually looking to reduce that amount of time, and that's where they've been focusing for the last couple of months, and what are the ways that they could actually make that happen faster.
Wow.
And so she developed that while she was in our studio, and then it was literally just an idea we would discuss. She continued to advance it until she actually worked with legislatures to actually have it approved in the state of Washington. And so we were the first state in the country to literally legalize the potential licensing of human composting as a third alternative. The other two exist in Washington, as in most places. And then since that time, other states have actually joined along. And so shortly after the governor signed the legislation, Katrina called me and we met, and she said, "Now's the time." She said, we now need to move towards making this a real place. And so Seattle will have the first recomposed facility. And my firm, and I'm working along with my colleague, Blair Payson, have been working with Katrina and her team to literally open this in about a year and a half. And so it'll be the first facility in the world where people can go. But it's unlike other types of death care. So perhaps we can talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll definitely dig a little bit more into that design aspect of it. And I have the website with some photos that we can pull up and look at while we're discussing as well. So we'll pull those up in a second. But I wanted to ask, what has been public perception and reception been of the project as far as people in the area that have found out about the project or government officials? Do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, I can share a number of things. The renderings that you may have seen from the website were created when she had leased a piece of property and we had begun to do design work. And so those were originally images we were using with her just to talk about what the sequence of experiences would be like for people as they arrived at this place. And the renderings were then posted on two design blogs. And what stunned us is how rapidly they literally spread across the globe. Hmm. And they have been picked up in countless numbers of periodicals. And what that indicates isn't necessarily that the majority of the world is ready to take this on. It does indicate that there was tremendous fascination with it, and that there was, and people were really curious. And if you read the comment sections on a number of these, and I haven't seen them all, but in a couple of them, and to answer your point, it really runs the gamut. And so there are people who are, and I have people that have actually written to me and asked me if there's a waiting list, if they can get on that. I've spoken to people who are terminally ill, who are incredibly intrigued and wish this was something that was available now. There are other people who it doesn't necessarily mesh with their spiritual beliefs, or it doesn't necessarily mesh with what they think is the proper way for people to be buried. And so I think it's safe to say that having a third alternative doesn't mean that the others wouldn't still exist for those at the moment that preferred them. But for everyone that chooses this, they are choosing just a different way to leave the world and a different message to give the planet.
To me, the idea or the time span of 3 months doesn't actually sound that long to me in comparison to what I would normally expect. So is it because you guys have created a special process for doing so? And I'd imagine so, because you're talking about even trying to reduce that time period.
Yeah. So I should be really clear with you guys and Jason and answer your question. We are designing the facility for Katrina, but we are not designing the vessel itself. And so that's something that she's working on with a team of people. And we are designing to fit it together, to create the rooms where these things will live and so on. But we aren't necessarily doing that. I think that there's a lot of aspects of how we're culturally accustomed to relating to death, which in some cultures is immediate. And I think the thing that's really interesting about the design project and about Katrina's idea is that she is interested in, if you were to have someone cremated, I do not know of a crematorium anywhere in the world where the memorial events would actually happen or could happen at the same place where the body is cremated. And if you think about funeral homes and traditional funeral homes experiences, and I don't know about you guys, but I've had sort of patently terrible experiences within those kind of environments personally. I'm intrigued with this idea that it could be a public place and that our attitudes about death, which currently are mysterious, you can't see into funeral homes. You can't see into these processes. There's a complete lack of transparency, but it's probably the most natural thing in the world. One of them, aside from being born, and twice as many people will be born every day that die. So it underscores the future need for having solutions, especially ones that will affect the climate. I just, that was very long-winded.
No, that's okay.
And I didn't answer your question, but I think the question is, because they don't know, if you were, suppose you wanted to take this organic soil and suppose it was a relative of yours and you wanted to take some of this soil and grow a tree in your backyard and have the tree become the memorial to the person that you love.
Correct.
You know, is it an adequate amount of time to wait for 3 months, for example, for that to happen? So I think there's many reasons that they're looking to condense that period. And it has a lot to do with, I think, just the ways that people are used to culturally dealing with death.
Totally agree.
I think it's surprising that we're now only talking about this. And the reality is there are so many people that actually do cremate their loved ones. And what happens is they disperse those ashes in the ocean or in rivers or in trees, you know, at the base of a tree in their backyard. So they're doing it anyways, but to do it the way that you're talking about and Katrina is talking about is really quite brilliant. It's surprising it's not happened before. And to your comment, Alan, about not knowing of a place where you could memorialize as a cremation is happening. Again, I mentioned in our primer that I'm half Asian, and so I've experienced some of the culture around death on the Asian and in the Thai, specifically in the Thai and Buddhist culture. And when my uncle passed away, it was really bizarre, but part of his ceremony and part of his memorial was literally his casket going into an oven.
Yeah.
And all of his closest family and friends standing around in this very sterile, industrial-like, bizarre back room of a cemetery in Los Angeles and watching them turn the oven on and hearing those noises. It was really surreal. It was really like, are we even supposed to be here? So it wasn't, you know, that was part of what his leaving was, but it was also like, this doesn't feel right. And it certainly, obviously, the space was not designed for people to be here, you know, saying their goodbyes. So what you and Katrina are doing is just really fascinating.
I agree. And again, I want the spotlight to be on Katrina. It's really is her concept, her idea, and she's kind of a force of nature. But Michelle, I want to acknowledge that I've heard, as you can imagine, so many forms of burial and approaches to death care. And a number of them, and particularly ones from Asian cultures or from the similar backgrounds, perhaps as yours, that have described an actual ceremony where the bereaved are actually with the deceased when the deceased body is actually put into the ovens. And I've heard some remarkable stories, some of them really fascinating and well done in some ways. It sounds like yours was perhaps bordered on the questioning whether that was the right way. But there is thought on this project from a design perspective, especially about as we design the spaces, about what the sequence will be like for people from the moment they arrive here, how they enter. They pass through a small Buddha bamboo garden, for example, because nature is a byproduct of what could become of your loved ones. They enter into spaces that a lot of thought has been given to how they gather, how they move closer to the body, the ability to see into the next space before you actually walk into it. The desire for some people to be alone with the deceased, that is the desire for some to have large crowds. There's also a desire, and you'll see from the renderings, to keep these spaces really respectful and acknowledge these as spiritual spaces without and trying to make space for any spiritual practice or belief to be able to establish their own rituals within the context of the recomposed facility. Here are some images that Demetrius is putting up that are showing. This is the main chamber where a variety of different kinds of gatherings can happen. This is a description of the process that Demetrius is showing that was a diagram that basically is that once you die, you're in this tray with that your family can actually help prepare. You are moved into the vessel. In a couple of months, you will be turned into organic compost with very, very low toxic sort of emissions, almost none. And then the ability for that soil to be used. And Katrina has been in conversation with different sustainable forests in the area who are thrilled at the prospect of having access to organic soil. So the idea that we could be feeding sustainable forests for others in the future, or where food could be grown or construction materials or other things, is actually an interesting way to leave the world. And frankly, it was one that was attractive to me.
Yeah, for sure. So, I love the idea.
So Alan, we started to talk about that design process a little bit and some of the concepts. Can you dig in a little bit more about your approach to this project and that process of the concept? Were you looking at other concepts or ideas? Because I've actually been looking to similar concepts internationally that have been available, and there's a lot of things that are out there of mushroom suits and different things like that. Were you looking at anything that's available now internationally, or?
I'm really glad that you brought that up, Demetrius. I think Katrina would be the first to admit, and I would agree with her, that we're in the middle of a kind of death care revolution where the need for alternative death care is really profound. And so there are movements literally all over the world, as you indicate, of people working on and researching different ways and more sustainable ways that people can actually sort of end their lives and leave the world. And so there are many that are going on, and we're certainly aware of them. And Katrina is very much a part of the death care sort of network. And many people that are advising her and on her committees and her teams actually come from different sort of areas and approaches to death care and how this can progress. And so we're at a moment where a lot of alternatives are being experimented with around the world. And it's exciting, I think, in that regard. There aren't, because of the United States and because of licensing and restrictions, there's a legality aspect in terms of what is technically legal in any given state. And as we discussed earlier, Washington State is now moving into the licensing realm, as is California, Colorado, and others. So I think we can look for this to become, and you know, it's not necessarily a political thing, in all honesty. It's literally just a third alternative. But what you're referring to are many other types of alternatives that also exist. And the thing to weigh is, when you're looking at all of these, is what's the one that might be right for you or someone you know, but also what is the impact that they have in relationship to the planet?
Mm-hmm. Now, most of those other ideas, concepts that are out there internationally, they're simply, I guess, in comparison, Katrina's concept is a vessel that converts to soil, and there's a lot of other ways that people were thinking of doing it, but this is the first facility that will house this process, correct?
To my knowledge, that's true. Certainly in the United States, I do not know of another facility that has been designed to provide an alternative facility besides the ones for cremation or traditional burial methods.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of cultures that have a lot of different approaches. And so and the ones I'm describing are largely Western. And so we need to acknowledge that there's many, many practices that happen. Think about the instances in India or in certain other continents and parts of the world where other practices that are conformed to other religious beliefs and spiritual beliefs also take place in relationship to how people are buried.
Yeah. Did you look to any other cultures for design influence on Recompose?
One of the things that we knew we wanted to do was to integrate nature. And so that became a sort of strong sort of guiding point for us. So at the very beginning, when you're arriving, and again, this is an ADA ramp, but virtually everyone enters the same way. So there's full accessibility for the elderly and so on that can come into the spaces. We also looked at spiritual spaces where daylight played a powerful role. I think there's something about the presence of daylight in space that can, in fact, provide a spiritual aspect. This is the chamber room, and it can be organized in a variety of ways where the vessels are stored. And you can see that there are these trees. Those literally can be moved around the room and arranged in different configurations so that whatever type of memorial can happen here. Katrina wants death care to be so transparent. She's even imagining having events here and literally having this be the kind of thing where it is not this sort of behind curtain experience, but is actually a more transparent part of our lives and an acknowledgement that this happens to virtually every one of us.
Yeah. Michelle, you had a question.
Yeah, I've got so many questions about just the space itself. So in terms of just building square footage and where do you locate a building like this and what is really the design and what's the capacity and how many ceremonies or memorials can take place at one time? And is there more of a back room space where the decomposing is actually just happening? I mean, I've got a lot of questions around that. Maybe you can touch on some of those.
Sure. Once you arrive and you come up this ramp, there's a number of different gathering spaces. And then these are spaces that are for private families where they can encounter the body for the first time. And there's a space before this where families can gather if individuals want to come in and spend time with the deceased as well. There's places here for projection. People can put up photographs, flowers. They can bring any spiritual sort of accoutrement that they want to engage in the room. And then the back wall opens, literally the wall opens, and then you move into what is then the laying in space, which is a large chamber. And it's located outside of Seattle, and it is a 100-year-old industrial building. And it has this beautiful, large bow truss, and it's made out of wood, and it's Douglas fir from the Pacific Northwest, so there's a tremendous amount of warmth. It spans 100 feet without columns, which was really sort of exciting to the team and to Katrina because it meant that we could have space, unobstructed spaces here. You can see on the left and right that there are about 75 vessels that are stored here, and there's the ability for more. The vessels are organized like a honeycomb. It's a shape taken from nature, from a beehive, essentially, and it's how they fit together and they work. And then there's a variety of different types of ways that people can gather. There can be large gatherings if it's a large memorial. There are also ways to configure the space if there are smaller and more intimate ones. And so the ways the spaces are used are become much more intimate.
And forgive me. So as I'm looking at the image right now, those circular. Okay. Yeah. So that one shows that it basically pops open and that's where the vessel slides into.
It does. Yes.
Okay.
Now there's a back of house behind that where additional soil and another door is in the back where additional soil can be added, composting soil, which actually aids in the composting process.
Very cool.
And what is the capacity of vessels that you've designed for and how many total building square feet?
And now these renderings suggest that this project is really far along and that like it's going to open in 2 weeks. We have a year and a half to go and there's going to be definitely some reconfiguration in the numbers and the amounts. And so, but I think it's in the range of 100 and is designed to go more and larger over time. So it's phased. It may start with a smaller amount initially and then actually over time increase. But there is a significant number of them that will be included.
Actually,
sorry, Michelle, just an answer to a question earlier. You know, how is this project unlike other projects? Well, in absolutely every respect it is. And so if you think about building permits, for example, there is no comparable project that a building department can look at this and say, oh, this is just like X, or it's not quite a funeral home. It's not quite a crematorium. It has its own sort of, so that the, I mean, there's been tremendous receptivity, I would say, from the city in terms of the project, but anything that is that has never been done before is going to sort of raise some eyebrows. And so that process is ongoing. So we are in pursuit of a building permit at the moment.
Can you talk a little bit about that experience of dealing with the city and how difficult it may have been, or how do you convince a plan checker to accept certain things when there's nothing to compare it to?
Well,
and I'm also curious about the zoning as well and just what land use designation something like this can be done in.
I think these are all really, really great questions. And I think that the fact that you're questioning them was that we also as a team were questioning like exactly how can this be received? And so We have not submitted for permit, but we're about to start on this sort of permit application. And so, you know, ask me in 4 to 6 weeks or 2 months I'll have probably have different answers for you. But as of today, what we did is we had preliminary meetings and just went into the city and talked about the project. And then they needed to sort of go back and think about exactly how this would be categorized. And so I would say in answer to your question, Michelle, nothing has landed as of yet, but it challenges, you know, almost all existing sort of jurisdictions in some respect, simply because it's the very first one.
That's so fascinating to me to be the first of something and having to, you're blazing the trail. So I assume as a team, you guys sort of wrapped your minds around what your opinion of what it would be categorized. And then you make a presentation to the city in some regard. And now they're, like you mentioned, they're kind of going back to think about what their opinion of it is. And there's going to be a little bit of back and forth probably.
You know, it's interesting. And I would say that my colleague Blair and I at Olson Kundig have had a lot of experience with one-of-a-kind projects that are really hard for cities to categorize. I'll give you one other example. We recently designed a $100 million remodel of Seattle Space Needle, which is, you guys might be familiar with it. It's this sort of iconic building that it symbolizes Seattle in many respects. And we were doing some pretty radical transformations of that. And when we were talking with the city before we submitted for permit, they were scratching their heads, like, what building typology is this? Is it a high rise? It's only four stories. It just happens to be 500 feet tall. And so we're somewhat accustomed to unusual projects and being able to work with the city to come up with an understanding and of how they could be interpreted. Demetrius, to your point, we, you know, in our own minds and our own experience, have thought of certain things would be perceived in certain ways, and then went in and began to ask the questions. And I have to say, the city of Seattle, in both instances, and this has happened on other projects as well, has been really, really open to trying to understand the differences here, and they've been really accommodating. But they certainly can only work within the sort of confines of how they interpret their own codes.
Yeah.
Alan, are you working with the city of Seattle? Is that the jurisdiction that it'll ultimately be developed and built in?
It is, and that's where we will be submitting the permit to them.
I was curious about the funding and financing and sponsor of a project like this. I mean, it sounds like Katrina is really the brainchild behind the whole thing, but is there a group of investors or how? Yeah, who's actually going to see this to fruition?
You're correct in that Katrina is overseeing the funding of the project. I think she has her own approach. I don't know a lot, in all honesty, about the details of how that's going. I just know that she's been successful up until now, partially because I think people sort of identify with this as a change they'd like to see in the world, and in some cases have been supportive of that. I know it's not an enormous amount of investors. I think she's thus far has been working with a smaller group, and it's usually people who I think she resonates with on a personal level and who she feels understand what it is she's trying to create, and have been working together. She is looking for, has been looking for donations and investors, and has been to some extent quite successful.
Alan, what's been the most complex part about taking this project on?
Without question, you know, so I'm going to back up on that question for a little bit to describe that every Thursday, and this includes us in quarantine, we're still doing this, but, you know, it's a firm of 200 people. And every Thursday before the virus and the pandemic, we would meet at 4:30 and we'd have beer and food and we would put a design project up on the wall and we would and the team working on it explains it. And then the whole office, from interns that just walked in the door from, you know, overseas, perhaps, to people that have worked in the firm for many, many decades, like myself. And everybody gets to chime in design-wise on their suggestions, their ideas. And it's, you guys know from your own experience, design critique is critique. And it's intended to be strong to make the projects better. And so our team posted this project and we described it. And I was unsure. It's the first time that probably over 100 people in my office were seeing it, and they had heard about it probably, but, and they were first chance that they could chime in on the design. And And there was one point where I just asked, and frankly, I'm going to ask the three of you this, and it's personal information and you don't have to share it if you don't want to. But I asked people there, and again, I said, don't raise your hand if you don't want to. But how many of you would consider this for yourselves? And there's a long pause. I see one. Jason's in. I would join you on that one. But almost every hand in the room went up. And that was kind of moving to me. And then the second piece that I think is unknown is how many would go to actually attend a memorial service in the same place where the body was being composed. Now, I don't, as you guys know, I don't take architects as a great sort of necessarily a beta test for how the rest of the world thinks or behaves. I think that we are, it's a separate entity in some ways in the way we look at some things, not everything, but some things. And so, but almost every hand went up there. And then I asked, well, how many of you would come and get soil to take home? Or would you be comfortable with it going to a sustainable forestry? And again, almost everybody wanted some soil, much like people want ashes to distribute. Now, again, this is not data. It's not hard science. It's just this reaction of you know, 150 people, perhaps, who were in the room at the time and who were interested in the project. So the challenges have been, and they're, you know, what great things, frankly, to be able to think about, and what an honor to think about something like this, is how to make that a space where every single person feels welcome, that this will be sensitive to their needs and what and the ways that they want to see the people they love or have known sort of moving on. And so, and that's taken so much conversation and design and trial and error. We experimented, for example, with color and the use of color in the space, for example, and we found, to one of your earlier questions, we began to look at spiritual spaces of many, many different practices. And there was something about the presence of daylight and the color white that was reemerged through so many colors and so many environments. So juxtaposing that with actual nature for us became a sort of cultural design palette that we were learning from other spaces and other experiences.
I think it's awesome. The whole thing I think is amazing. I mean, the space itself, I come from a very Catholic background. So, you know, using to attend those types of services and everything, and just visualizing the space that you guys are talking about, seeing the daylight, the nature, you know, because I guess going back to the opening piece of it, it's all a very natural thing. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't have to be uncomfortable. You know, I think we can thank Hollywood for that. Right. But, ultimately from what I would call, it's not a viewing room, but, you know, the room where he had, it's much more personal space, family oriented, you know, that type of, I can't remember, you know, like a viewing is what it would be. Right. Very similar, but just a beautiful space then to open up and everything else for people to pay their last respects, do that and just know that. And it gets into the religious stuff too, right? Depending on your background with that and how some people are, but we know it's not necessarily the body that matters. It's the soul at some point, depending on your background. And, you know, I've always laughed when even my wife and I had talked about it before, the idea of, you know, I don't need to be buried. Nobody needs to come visit me, but how cool would it be to provide shade for somebody else at some point, or, you know, people that love construction, right? And have such a heart for that type of thing to potentially go into building that of another person's, you know, home and docile and all those types of things. I think it's amazing. And the space itself is just, especially with that bridgeway that you're talking about, the trusses and how open that is and how beautiful that is. I'd buy my ticket soon. You know what I mean? Once it's available. I think you guys did a fantastic job. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I want to acknowledge that not everybody in the world is going to agree with you, but
they're wrong. They're wrong. We know this. We already tell people all the time, if they're not on that side, they're wrong. It's okay.
I just think, what is the alternative? I've been wrestling as we've been talking on this podcast about what the pros and, or what the cons rather are to going through this process. And I haven't yet been able to come up with one for myself. And I absolutely recognize that, you know, every culture has a different spiritual belief and a different belief about how the body and the soul exit the earth. But for me personally, I haven't been able to find a con. I don't know why you wouldn't do this, because the alternative is you're put in your best attire and put in a beautiful wooden casket and lowered into the earth's surface. Or you're cremated and your ashes are, you know, either taken somewhere or put in an urn or put in a wall at a cemetery. And so why, if I guess the what I've been trying to ask myself as we've been talking is, why wouldn't you want to decompose and be used for something purposeful and useful? I guess to help the sustainability of the world. And I haven't been able to come up with an answer. I did have one question though, because I thought, you know, when you do cremate, ashes are very, very heavy. I don't know if any of you have ever had the opportunity to lift a body that's been cremated. I was curious, is that also the case with the soil? Is the soil, is that heavy as well? Do we know anything about that?
I realize I've been using the word decompose, and Katrina would correct me, because she really is using recompose as the this is a process which I think is unlike others, and so I'm correcting myself in that regard. And hearing you guys play it back to me, it is a new version. But I think the answer to the question, I think that you know, people listening to this won't see, but the three of us were nodding our heads, like, because I think each of us has held ashes in our hands and the weight of that. I think anyone that has held soil or earth or has worked in the garden knows what the weight of that is, and that, Michelle, is essentially what it would be like. And a human body will, through this recompose process, will create about a cubic yard of soil, which is a lot of soil. And it's not clear that every family will want all of it necessarily, much like not every family takes all of the ashes. And so, but again, there is real interest from sustainable forests in our region in having access to this if people don't want it themselves. And so it becomes this other kind of memorial where your loved one is part of a forest. And a part of an interconnected natural environment.
I am clearly all in on this. That's why I asked you to come on, Ellen. So you had me already before you even joined us today. So, but
I think Demetrius, it's safe to say that the four of us, given our backgrounds, are probably predisposed to this because of the kinds of issues that face our lives and our careers, especially in relationship to climate change and the environment. It's interesting for me to hear, and obviously the three of you, this is not the first time you've heard of it. So you've had some time to think about it and so on, but it's interesting when you ask someone for the very first time, or you describe it to them for the very first time, they have to have a moment. You can see like menus are scrolling down in their brain, as they're trying to sort of reconcile, like, is this right? And is it right for me?
Yeah. What's interesting about that, and I know I'm going a little bit on a limb, is I'd tell you most likely it's not because of their initial thought for themselves. It's the social judgment on that. You know what I'm saying? Like, where does that fit in comparison? Because, you know, I think when you get a lot of knee-jerk responses from people and they're willing to respond quickly, that's really what they think. When they take their time, it's that whole judgment of, am I saying the right thing or not?
Oh, interesting.
I mean, that's a guess from my side.
Yeah,
but I don't.
I'm not sure you could be right that there's a kind of self consciousness, perhaps.
Yeah, because I mean,
it's anything that's new, and so
exactly. So, man, I hope you guys hit it hard and hit it running, you know, and get through it quick. I mean, it just be. I think it's awesome. it's just very cool.
Ellen, was there any issue or hiccup that you guys had to try to resolve through design as you were approaching this project? Something that you had to work on for either the primary user or secondary user?
Well, I think I like the way you're phrasing the latter part of your question, Demetrius, because there are two user groups here, if you think about it. It's probably many if you study it. But there are the people who will be coming to sort of deliver the deceased and to memorialize them and pay tribute to them. But there also is the deceased themselves, and they are in and of themselves their own sort of user group here. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a lot of thought about how that arrival happens and care that it takes, how that body is transitioned and how the body is prepared for others to experience it and to say goodbye, have been given a tremendous amount of thought. And the renderings that you were showing earlier, and people can find them online, we never overtly said this in the creation of these seven images. And the images were created by Ryan Botts in our studio, who's a very talented architect. And so we did those images in-house just to visualize what it could be like. But it's actually the path that a deceased body would experience coming to the place, although you never actually never overtly says that. So, you know, seeing ramps as the arrival and then the first viewing space and then moving into the chamber and then moving into the vessels themselves, that is the path that the deceased would have. And so there is an underlying thread that holds all those images together in that respect.
Yeah. Is there something in society that's changing in your mind that will either accelerate acceptance or be an obstacle for a Recompose team?
I'll be honest. I think we have a lot to make happen in a year and a half. And again, it's not the first time that I feel like we've been in the situation where we're working on a design project that doesn't have the clearest path because of its sort of uniqueness. And so there will be bumps in the road for sure, but we're feeling super optimistic that this simply has to happen. And I think the world is ready for it. I think that climate change has, and the sort of consciousness around climate change has also made this an incredible, this and the other death care alternatives extremely attractive to many people in the world. It's like, I don't think people want the carbon associated with cremation to be going into the air we breathe. I don't think people want land to be locked down for eternity so that it can never be used for other types of things. And so I think that aspect of it feels timely in relationship to just what's going on in relationship to the planet. There is one other aspect of sustainability and the end of life, however, that's not necessarily related to the Recompose process or Katrina's project. But one of the sort of largest sort of carbon impacts in death is actually traveling to a funeral. And the numbers of people who are getting on planes and moving planes and cars and traveling great distances or around the world to be able to sort of commemorate an individual has an enormous impact. And what I'm fascinated by, because I've been wondering in my own mind, is are there other ways for people to gather? And frankly, in the last 3 and 4 weeks, we've learned that there are. I had an office meeting with 177 people on Monday with the others and my colleagues in the office. And this experience that we're all having at the moment may force us to really think of the ways that we convene in the future and just imagine how much less of a sort of carbon footprint issue it would be if we were actually able to sort of attend these things and experiencing them and feel them without necessarily having to fly around the world to do so.
Yeah. So assuming this takes off, I think it will, and you guys may or may not get all of the project's future Recompose sites, but if another company or if another designer took on a similar facility, what's one thing that you would recommend them to consider at any level, a designer, someone who's building it, that you may have encountered or foresee being a big consideration approaching this type of facility?
Yeah, I'll be honest, we're not looking at it from a sort of a business perspective. We may only do one. And that, from my standpoint, that in and of itself would be an honor to work on. We have been really lucky as a firm to get to work with some incredibly entrepreneurial thinkers and so people walk in the door with big ideas and they need design to help them realize that. And so it's like just a huge challenge and such a great thing to be able to work on. I know that will probably continue. Katrina Spade had that in spade. Sorry, I almost said she has it in spades, which is my bad pun. She just is one of those people that had an enormous idea and had the force of energy to actually deliver it and make it happen. And so I would always be open to talking with her about any other things that she would want to do in the future, but I also see that she could work with others. And what's most important is that this happens in a way that improves the environment, that engages people in a positive alternative, and for those that align with it or that feel like it's the right choice for them.
Thank you for that. And thank you so much for joining us, Alan. This has been great. Love the project. And I think this was an amazing conversation.
Thank you. I'm a fan of your podcast, especially in the last couple of months. And so keep up the great work. And I'll look forward to listening to you guys in the future.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks so much, Alan. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
It was awesome.
That's all for this episode, but keep listening for a sneak peek of our next episode. This show is part of the Gable Media Network. You can check out similar content at GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. You can help support what we're doing here by leaving a 5-star rating and a review on your preferred podcasting app. It helps others find us, and your support is the only way that this show grows. And don't forget to connect with us through our Facebook community, Instagram, and see the random thoughts and articles that we share on Twitter and LinkedIn. But before you go, next time on Spaces Podcasts.
I mean, I've been involved in housing most of my career. You start with a sort of general concept and you get more and more specific as you go along. And it's a sort of slow process. With modular, it's like, oh no, you're right up front figuring all this stuff out in intense detail. And it's kind of, it is fun to do that. What you need though is, you know, the whole team has to be interested in doing that. That's what I feel like is sort of the most fun part, is we're kind of engineers, architects, the manufacturer, we're kind of in each other's business, right? We say, here's what we want to do. They say, no, you can't do that. We say, why not? Why don't we try this? And they say, here's why. And it's this real collaborative process of design, which is, it's super fun, real engaging.
And thank you again for spending some time with us. Talk soon.
Small firm entrepreneur architects, get ready to build a better business with the Entree Architect podcast, where business meets architecture. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, the host of Entree Architect podcast. Join me every week for inspiring interviews with passionate people that share proven strategies to help you build a better business.
If you think there is a problem, one, you can't make a move until you have a plan in place. The accountability chart really helps plan, okay, for the business 6 to 12 months out, this is what we need.
We cover it all, from financial management to marketing, sales, productivity, and beyond.
There's two sides of it, right? So there's the one when you don't have any work. So you're like, well, I'm either going to charge enough to be profitable or I'm going to go out of business. Or you have so much work and you have backlog and you don't need any more work. So you charge way more.
I'd also say lagging measures, one of the best, like the best. So for any client, for any professional service company, if you're going to take one thing away from what we're talking about today, is to look at a number called the labor efficiency ratio.
Entree Architect is not just a podcast. It's your secret weapon for success. With over 500 episodes, it's one of the longest running architecture podcasts in the world. You're sure to find the information you need to elevate your business. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now and join the community of small firm entrepreneur architects building better businesses.